This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the Trump administration ramps up immigration enforcement, we turn to a story that gives a lesser-told perspective on American immigration. For 32 years, New York Times reporter Jason DeParle followed the story of the Villanuevas, three generations of a family that made their way from the slums of Manila to Houston, Texas, and who are the subject of his latest book, A Good Provider is One Who Leaves. Back in 1987, at the age of 26 and 5 years into his journalism career, DeParle found himself in search of a greater purpose.
The last set of stories I did in New Orleans was on the Charity Hospital system, and my sources were largely young residents who were just a few years older than me then, and I thought they were very romantic figures. They could take somebody who came in with a gunshot wound and stitch them up, and all I could do is write about them for the Daily Fish Wrapper.
He made his way to the Philippines to figure out what to do with his life. He wanted to understand poverty, so he moved into the slums, renting some floor space in the home of a woman named Tita.
She was a mother of five kids who had moved from a farm 50 miles away into the slums of Manila, initially to work in a factory and make money, and got married and settled down in a shantytown there. Her husband, Emmett, was a guest worker in Saudi Arabia, a pool maintenance man at a Saudi airbase. And Tita was raising her five children on the money he sent back.
So what kind of life was she living?
Tita had a double life, a life of drudgery as a mother of five children in a shanty in Manila, washing, scrubbing, cooking all day and looking after these kids. But she had this really rich inner life, and she was a part of this slum uplift group, which was revolving around the question, what would Jesus do if Jesus lived in a shantytown? They had Bible studies and livelihood projects, and they went to protests. And Tita's role in the group was in the co-op stores. She brought in 2,000 eggs a week. She was the buyer of the eggs, and she stacked them under a fluorescent light in her shanty to keep away the rats.
So you were there for 8 months. You slept on the floor. You weren't the only one.
Tita and her five kids slept upstairs, and there were four of us sleeping on the floor downstairs. My mom recently died, and I was cleaning out her house. I found letters that Tita had written to my mother and father when I was living with her, you know, 30 years ago, just assuring her that I was okay and not to worry, that she was looking out for me. As those 20 years pass, all five of the kids have become migrant workers just like their father.
You focus on one of them. Mm-hmm. You meet her when she's 15, mm-hmm. and her name is Rosalie.
Yeah, she's the middle of Tita's five kids. She uses her father's remittances to make the leap from the slums to nursing school. If you were going to pick a kid with the drive to get out of the shantytown, I don't think you would have picked Rosalie. She was very shy, diffident. There were others who were stronger or more self-confident or more outgoing or more academically gifted. Years later, I got her high school transcript, and the most revealing element of her transcript wasn't her grades. It was her attendance through 4 years of high school when the Philippines was literally in revolution. She never missed a day. Eventually gets a job in Saudi Arabia, moves to the Persian Gulf with her hopes of getting to the U.S. Initially, I felt really sorry for her, like poor Rosalie has to go to Saudi Arabia. And in her way of telling it, it was lucky me, I get to go. The poorest of the poor don't get to migrate. They can't afford to migrate. The book takes its title from a conversation I had with Tita's sister, who was watching her siblings who had gone abroad come home and build cement block homes. She was living in a grass hut, and she turned to her husband, encouraging him to go abroad as well, and said to him, a good provider is one who leaves. And that kind of became the family motto.
This is a monumental theme in your story. It's pivotal. You realize that the story of immigration is much bigger than is usually told.
Tita's one of 11 siblings. Nine mm-hmm. in her generation went abroad or had siblings or did. Then if you picture a second generation of cousins, there's 45 first cousins on one side of Rosalie's family. 25 of them have made the leap from shantytown squalor to a middle-class life at the cost of spending most of their life as guest workers.
And the Philippines is exceptional with regard to this kind of foreign employment because the government actively supports it. But it is by no means unique in relying on these remittances. In the book, there's a number, a statistic that you keep returning to, and it's that global remittances, that is to say, the money sent home, is more than three times the foreign aid budget worldwide.
Migration is the world's anti-poverty program. Emmett, when he left the Philippines,
Rosalie's father, Tita's husband,
he was a pool maintenance man in Manila. When he went to do exactly the same work in Saudi Arabia, his salary rose tenfold. When the Ellis Island immigrants came to the U.S., they could expect to maybe triple their earnings from what they were getting in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now a low-skilled migrant coming to the U.S. might expect to make seven or eight times as much. So the economic rewards to migration are just much greater than they've ever been.
Your book spans three generations, and it isn't just about grandparents, mothers, and children. It's about cousins and their individual stories.
Not everyone is successful. Some of the families lost their incomes being cheated by unethical middlemen. Some people went abroad and wound up losing their marriages to adultery or becoming alienated from their kids. Tragic story where one character, a worker on a cruise ship, wound up losing his leg.
The coping strategies that they used to try and maintain their marriages or to offer parental guidance are unique to the era.
Emmett, the father, went abroad in 1980. When he wanted to communicate with the family, he would make a cassette tape. They'd get it weeks later. They'd all gather around and listen to it. They'd make one and send it back, you know, and that could take 2 months. By the time his children are abroad, they can keep in touch with their children instantaneously. Rosalie could know what her kids had for breakfast. Sometimes she would just put a Skype connection on just to listen to the sounds of them laughing back in the Philippines or hear the sounds of a rooster crow. The other thing that happens in the course of the 30 years is that migration feminizes. So the first generation, when Emmett went, was mostly men doing male work in Saudi, like construction, you know, building roads and bridges. When the second generation goes, because it's largely women going as caregivers and nurses, and when they go, a lot of them leave children behind.
Rosalie's family does embody a number of these trends that you're talking about. Her husband, Chris, was compelled to follow her because she was a stunningly empathic and skilled nurse, much the bigger earner. You get into the specific and the personal challenges of their integration into American life.
Rosalie gets her big break in 2012. A hurricane has hit Galveston Island, destroyed the hospital, and it can't get enough American nurses to come back onto the island. So they started hiring foreign nurses. Rosalie was one of 20. 19 of them were women. So you had 19 or so men trailing spouses following the women, most of the men experiencing downward mobility.
It's funny, normally when we think of upward and downward mobility, we don't separate the wives and the husbands if it's the wife who's following along.
The guys are all dealing in one way or another with a kind of blow to their male ego, and that became a theme all the nurses had to deal with. When it first happened, I think the hope among feminists was it would be a story of upward empowerment, but it was a lot more complicated than that because the men were upset and the women felt like they needed the men in their families. They needed strong men for their children. So the women end up bending over backwards in all kinds of different ways mm-hmm. to make the men still feel like they're respected and the head of the household. In Rosalie's case, she took out the mortgage in her name alone and put her and her husband's name on the deed.
Mm-hmm.
So he would feel like he owned the house even though she was paying for it.
Let's talk about some numbers here. How immigration expanded in the last century.
In 1924, we passed a very restrictionist immigration law aimed at keeping out basically Italians and Jews. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson passed a law taking away those discriminatory quotas and opening up immigration again. But he promised that neither the numbers would rise nor the demographic mix would change. Those were two profoundly wrong predictions. Instead, the foreign-born share of the population is now near all-time highs. It's close to 14%, and 85% of the people who've come since 1965 have come from the developing world.
In the history part of your book, one of my favorite moments was an effort by a congressman, a 14-term Democrat from Ohio, Michael Feehan, to tweak Johnson's bill so as to ensure that the majority of immigrants would still be Anglo-white. Johnson wanted skills to be a determinant of whether you'd get in or not. And Feehan said, no, it should be if you have family here, on the assumption that you would be able to keep the same demographic mix because those families are here. But he didn't think about a whole bunch of immigrants, including a lot of Filipinos, who were already here.
Exactly. We now think of family-based immigration as being a leftist idea, right?
The chain migration is one of the disasters. You allow one person in, yeah, and that one person brings in 10 or 12 people.
No doubt. The people who want to restrict migration want to make it a skills-based system as opposed to a family-based system. In 1965, it was exactly the opposite. The family-based system was set up to be restrictive because the people who didn't want more immigration figured if you had to be related to somebody who was already here, you'd basically get white immigration. What they didn't understand is that there was still a small part that would come through other means. The people coming from the developing world had the biggest incentive to bring their relatives. And I think that's important to remember if you're trying to grasp the complicated nature of the current moment, where we have two competing narratives, right? At the national level, we have a narrative of pure political conflict, the Trumpian anti-immigrant wing versus the expansionist Democratic Party that embraces a majority-minority country. At the daily lived level, it's often much more a story of acceptance. And I think about Houston, deep in red state America, where Rosa Lee wound up. When I was growing up, Houston was a city of honky-tonks and rodeos, and if you'd told me there were going to be Hindu temples in the suburbs of Houston, I would have predicted a great amount of conflict, right? And instead, it's an extremely pro-immigrant city that celebrates its diversity. And I think both narratives are important to keep in mind, both the acceptance and the conflict. If you don't have both in mind, I think you're not getting the full story.
There's a relatively low crime rate in many border towns like El Paso.
If there's a single Trump criticism of immigration, it's that it causes crime, and yet virtually every study ever done on immigrants and crime has shown that immigrants have lower crime rates than the native-born.
And yet vitriol spews out on this issue regularly from the man in the White House, and it may have been what put him in office, at least in part.
But again, we can't think of immigration as only being the story of national political conflict. It's also the story of Rosa Lee in the hospital ward taking care of people from every walk of American life and earning their deep gratitude, from 80-year-old African-American sharecroppers to aging, affluent white engineers.
You are like the Zelig for this family there at so many crucial moments. And you frequently offer a helping hand, a call to a consulate to fast-track a visa or a call to an emergency room doctor. You have blended the roles of reporter, confidant, friend.
By the time I decided to write the book, I'd known them for 20 years. I'd lived with them. I was kind of quasi-kin, you know. The time you mentioned about the consulate was the only time, I think, where I really questioned whether I should do something. And what happened in that incident was Rosa Lee had been approved for her visa, but she hadn't gotten it yet. And she was about to miss her plane. I had a meeting with an official in the embassy, and I was trying to decide, should I mention this or not? And at that point, I think the friend and journalist issue was in conflict, because the journalist part of me thought it would be better if actually she didn't get the visa, she missed the plane. She would have been late to her job in Texas, and, you know, it would have made a point that for all the talk of open borders, they're not so open. It would have illuminated, I think, the struggles that even a privileged migrant like a nurse has. So on the one hand, I wanted to just let the story play out naturally, and on the other hand, Rosa Lee had been trying to get to the United States for 20 years, and this seemed like a very nice official in the embassy, and she immediately knew what to do and took care of it.
But you weren't specifically thinking too much about the so-called Heisenberg effect on all of this. I mean, you're there, you're asking questions of the parents, asking the kids to consider their lives in ways that kids often would not.
I did an earlier book on a group of welfare families. I was going to follow them for some years and see how they did leaving the welfare system. And I was very worried in that instance that I didn't want to change the story by observing it. What I ended up deciding was that no matter what I did, it wasn't going to change things, that the dynamics of that family were deeply established.
Back in December of 2018, my co-host Bob spoke with the writer Masha Gessen. She suggested that the media spend one day only reporting on immigration stories to help us understand the scale of the issue. She also thought it was important to focus on individual stories. You must feel that putting very detailed faces on the problem is key.
It was just a great privilege and a daily joy to just hang out with them. Whether it was with Tita in the slums 30 years ago or her grandchildren in the Texas public schools, obviously I kept going because I wanted to offer a detailed story, and I thought it had a global importance, but it was also just a lot of fun to tell.
Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason DeParle is a reporter for The New York Times. His book is called A Good Provider is One Who Leaves. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chattavetti. We had more help from Anthony Bansi and Eloise Blondio. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.